I've been to Napa Valley, California only one time. A few years ago, Susan and I went for a long weekend, and it was great, except that it rained every day, every moment of every day. Other than that, it was wonderful. And, never mind that. It was because it was great to just to visit the number of vineyards and wineries and learn some of the finer points of the vintner's art. Wine was everywhere, you can imagine. Even the local pizza joint served wine by the glass that you would be hard-pressed to find here in some of the finest restaurants. So, in that time, that short weekend, I did not become an expert. I learned a few simple things. But I'll tell you this, I never saw anyone fill a jar with water and pour out the finest Cabernet from the most outstanding vintage. It just isn't done, right? It takes time, it takes patience, it takes knowledge and skill and grapes, of course, and some luck to get there. But that visits in my mind when I read and hear John chapter 2. Because I wonder what all of those hardworking vineyard folks would think if they experienced that moment. They would taste things that I can only imagine. They would run scenarios in their minds I know nothing about. But my guess is that they know so much about it that in the end, it wouldn't be about the wine at all. They would just exclaim, "Who did this? Who did this?" And in our response to this miraculous sign, that's really the point for us, too. It's the thing that many in the story actually miss because they don't know where it comes from. They don't know who did it. They just marvel and wonder at it. We're in a season of revelation, aren't we? This time after Epiphany, from now until Ash Wednesday. The manifestation or the revealing of Jesus is always the theme in front of us in these weeks. Who he is, what his mission is about, his identity and his calling. And we'll be exploring these themes. And we don't explore them just for information. We explore so that we would experience again what it is to see who he is, to believe in him, to follow him, that we would take on his life, and then we would reveal him to others. That's the point. In John's gospel, it's the first miracle or the first sign that we have pointing the way to Jesus' identity and authority. And John uses this word sign instead of miracle, and it's for a reason, I think, because signs point somewhere, right? They're not just in and of themselves. They're for a purpose. And the purpose, if we go to John chapter 20, is that we would believe in him. And so these are signs. They point somewhere. They point to who he is. They point to what he is here to do. They look to Jesus' authority. And you know, there's much about this sign in John 2 that's left untold. There's just a lot there that we don't know, many details, such as why are Jesus and the disciples even there? Is this family? Is it friends? Why is his mother so concerned to save face? Right? And I think a really important one is where did they get the water anyway? 180 gallons, let's say, of fresh water, that's not an easy task in that place. And in that kind of quantity. We're just not told those things, but we're not to worry about it either. That's not the point. Too often we get buried in the weeds of details and we miss the big picture anyway when we start layering out our own expectations on the text. So I always want to kind of caution us about that when we start looking at the miracles of Jesus and his parables and signs and so on. At the end of John chapter 1, at the calling of Nathanael, Jesus tells him that he would see great things. He would see heaven open. He would see the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And then, right into chapter 2, on the third day, which is an important theological phrase, by the way, it points to the resurrection. This sign at the wedding occurs. This sign is the fulfillment of what he told Nathanael. You're going to see things you have no explanation for. John gives his testimony about Jesus in chapter 1. The Lord begins to call his followers, and then right away, before we're even ready for it, we start to see just that. Things greater than we can imagine. Again, I think there's a lot here that could be analyzed, and often we want to get a handle on it, and we want to kind of figure out the signs and miracles that Jesus does, but we should be careful, because in the end, our words and our concepts fail us. And if we think we can get to a place where we can fully comprehend and fully explain what has just happened, then we'll be disappointed, and we'll miss the point as well. Jesus, who are you? What are you doing here? What should we know about you? Can you just fill out this questionnaire for us? And Jesus' response is, here, taste this. Taste this. So I want us to walk carefully and remember those words of his, that just that invitation to taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste this wine and know. By the way, I've preached this sermon before, not this sermon, but on this Sunday when we were at other building with a bottle of wine opening it, but I didn't want to be arrested by Trinity security in the middle of the sermon. So just to have to imagine. There are themes here, important themes, and I'm drawn to some of those themes, and so I wanted to take a look at the themes. John tells us in chapter 1 that the coming of the Word made flesh, means the arrival of grace upon grace. That's in verse 16. See, Jesus' first sign is not a judgment. It's not a call to repentance, even though that's very important. His first sign is a sign of grace. It's a gift. It's just a gift. There's a need there, and in a way, it's kind of a mundane need, isn't it? I mean, it's urgent, but it's not the most important thing in the world, really. It's a normal thing. It's part of everyday life. It's like so many other situations that we face in our lives that are troubling, potentially disastrous, as it could have been for some of these servants, perhaps. But in the end, it's common. Jesus is there at a wedding, a normal thing. The gift of wine endorses not only that event, but so many other events that we find ourselves in, things that make human life meaningful and pleasant. And this sign requires nothing of those in attendance except that they drink it, that they receive it, and that they enjoy it. And most of those at the wedding that day don't even know where it came from. They have no idea. The servants know. The disciples, they know. But it's sort of hidden. It's just a gift. Who's it from? There's no return card on this. Doesn't that bother us when we get a gift and we don't know who it's from? Who sent you flowers? I don't know. That, you know, that kind of a thing. But it's not a very good start to a ministry if you're trying to get the word out, right? You should hand out a card with every glass that says, this wine was transformed from ordinary water just a few minutes ago, and there's the guy who did it over there. Talk to him on the way out. No, this miracle, this sign, is grace expressed. And it's graceful. The word comes to be grace in our midst, in our fragmented and vulnerable communities, in our hearts, in our expectations of life that so many times are not met, in places of real need and confusion, in places of misunderstanding. Wine is freely given. Grace is poured out over us. Paul tells the Corinthian church, which, by the way, is a place so in need of healing and unity and, you know, put the fighting down, guys. He tells them, you've already been given all you need to be the people of God and do what God has called you to. He tells them, he says, I don't want you to be ignorant, just sort of like a nice way of saying you're ignorant. You have a variety of gifts of the Spirit, one Spirit. Don't fight over them. All right, God gives these. God gives them freely. They all come from the same source, and they are gifts. You did not earn them. You didn't qualify for them in any way. It's not because you're so spiritual. They're just God's gift to you, to the whole community, so that you can be his people. Do what he's asked you to do. Receive them. Let them do their work. I think it's hard for us to embrace this truth sometimes, the truth of grace. It can be very difficult. The gospel of grace. We'd feel better if we had to compete for it, or to earn it, or pass an exam. But it's grace, just given, unmerited. It's not a badge for good behavior. It's the wine at Cana. It's a gift. You know, there are many gifts in our midst here. We're all gifts to one another. People, abilities, willingness, commitment, faith, and so on. And I've learned over time to trust that, to trust God's gifting, because I can get really nervous easily about certain things. And it's amazing that when we have a need at Redeemer, so often and so many times, someone shows up that has particularly that gift or that experience to help us in something that we need as a community. And I've seen it so many times that I'm coming to a place, I hope, of trust where I can just say, it's okay, God's got that. Yeah, but what are we going to do about this? I know God's got that. It's all right. So we see grace in the miracle of Cana. We also see abundance, don't we? I mean, really, we do. It's gallons and gallons of wine. It's over the top. And I can just imagine it sloshing around on the ground and all of that as they're moving these huge stone jars. It's over the top, and the wine is amazing. It's the kind of wine that could only be the best of the best. And, you know, this isn't wine by the glass either, right? This isn't, would you like a 5-ounce pour or an 8-ounce pour? This is wine by the bucket full. And it's almost a little comical, I think. There's something about this narrative that's, it makes us smile because we don't know how to act sometimes in the face of true abundance. I don't. There's more wine here than is needed, I think, but it doesn't matter. Jesus transforms water into what's probably hundreds of bottles of wine equivalent, so extravagant. And to our good Midwestern ethic, it even seems wasteful. But this sign points to something and to someone, and the nature of that someone. It reveals the extravagant love of God, who would not withhold his own, but risk everything. It looks forward to the messianic banquet when there will be no shortage of blessing. It signals that the kingdom of God is breaking in, challenging all of our rationing and our self-imposed limitations. Often in our lives, we do not experience abundance. It's true. And many in the world are starving for basic needs. And this story, this event needs to, you know, we need to see it in light of that, or else we can be drawn into kind of a gospel of prosperity, and we don't want to go that direction, because the world is a hard place with deprivation of many kinds. And yet, this notion of abundance that God has given us compels us to share what we have, doesn't it? To be open and free and hold our hands openly with what God has given us, the love, the experience, wisdom and friendship, life. But our God is not a God of scarcity. He's giving all we need to be the people that he's calling us to be. He's pouring out his blessings on us and through us. And so I think we want to ask for wisdom to discern their presence so we can really see what it is that God's gifting us in, that we would taste and see that the Lord is good. I think about this in terms of sacraments in the church. I mean, sacraments are those signs. They point us to the deeper realities, the deeper mysteries. I had early in my life a professor who really talked a lot about liturgy and worship and so on. He had this little saying. He said, "Stingy sign, stingy God. Abundant sign, abundant God." And his way of saying is, don't hold back. Don't give out little crackers for communion. You know, give bread. Don't hold back. Don't be stingy about the things. If you're going to do a baptism, use lots of water. Get it everywhere. Let people know that God's not stingy. There's an abundance there. And I think more and more, and as we move into our new location in Highwood, we're going to move into that feeling of abundance in our sacraments. We're a little held back here. That's okay. We're sojourning a bit. But I think that's important. It's theological. It's about our community. It's about saying, oh, isn't God good? This is abundant. So there's grace here. There's abundance. And, you know, there's also just delight and wonder in it. in this miracle, this sign. There's a famous theologian, now deceased, he died actually just about 1 year ago this month, that I met at seminary. We actually met over a cup of coffee after chapel, and they would always have a time of coffee in the common room, and I chatted with him from time to time. We weren't friends, really, but I came to just be so glad of the opportunity to be in his presence. Some of you, this won't mean anything, but for some of you, I can tell you his name was George Lindbeck. And the thing I remember about George Lindbeck isn't all the things that he wrote, which were amazing, and the fact that he worked, you know, in churches, and he was a Lutheran, but he went to Vatican II, and all these wonderful things that he did. But what I remember is seeing him walk in the rain. And there was raining one time, and people were out with their umbrellas and, you know, rushing for cover and getting out of the storm. And he was just walking down the sidewalk with his face turned up to the sky in delight and wonder. You know, Cana has delight and wonder all through it. It really does. Providing wine for a wedding party is not world-changing, is it? Not really, even though it does allow the steward and bridegroom to avoid shame. But as Matthew Skinner suggests, not every act of God has to turn the world upside down or carry cosmic significance. He says this, Jesus' signs are less about cognitive instruction than they are about existential knowing. They're encounters with divine love. Encounters that lead us to delight and wonder. Jesus, who are you? What are you doing? Here, taste this. Taste this. In the miracle at Cana, we see God's divine glory revealed in something that touches on the everyday, something we know and can understand. And it's so amazing, it's so extravagant and rich that we smile. I smile at this. It's just like, wow. It brings delight. It's a sign of the kingdom of God, and we wonder at it. For Martin Luther, this miracle here was a good reminder that we should take delight and wonder in all of the marvelous divine activity that goes on that we just take for granted. Here's what he said. He said, God's wonderful works, which happen daily, are lightly esteemed, not because they're of no import, but because they happen so constantly and without interruption. Man is used to the miracle that God rules the world and upholds all creation, and because things daily run their appointed course, it seems insignificant. No one thinks it worth his while to meditate upon it and to regard it as God's wonderful work, and yet it is a greater wonder than that Christ fed 5,000 with 5 loaves and made wine from water. So there's room for us to grow in our delight and wonder at all of what God does, not just these kind of really amazing things that break out every now and again, like the signs in John's gospel. The miracle at Cana seems to me almost a metaphor, really, for something larger, and that is the celebration of life itself. I see that here. This is just, you know, this abundant pouring out of wine affirms life. It affirms celebration. It says, life's good. Life's good. Many churches observe today as the sanctity of life Sunday. And it's important to do that. It really is, to affirm the sacredness of life, to honor it, to see it as God's abundant gift. And usually, the theme is associated with right-to-life concerns that have to do with abortion on demand in our country. And I affirm those concerns and the sacredness of the unborn. That's extremely important. But too often, though, we stop there. We put a lot of energy into that, and then we back away, don't we? Moses' command to the people to choose life was about seeking God's ways and living them faithfully for all of life. Not just one issue, as important as that is, and vital as it is, but the many things from conception to death that make up what it is to live. For the people of God, this traditionally was, of course, the law, the Torah, but also the special concerns for the widow, and the orphan and the stranger. And these responsibilities have not been removed from us. They're transformed in ways, of course, in the coming of Jesus. But what does it mean to choose life except that we are to know His grace, abundance, delight, and wonder, and help others to know those things as well? To be agents of life. There are people at Redeemer who work at the intersections of life in all the way through in all these various areas, and I'm going to point out just a few of them today for further conversation you might wish to have, but also not to leave anyone out, too. So, and I started thinking through this and having a little bit of conversation with a couple of them. Ruth Gleason serves as a nurse and a counselor with those facing very crisis pregnancy situations. And she does that work in the context of grace. And it's so important at that point, that beginning point, before breathing, before we see the child. Susan Greener teaches human development and issues around children and children at risk and the importance of supporting children right through to adulthood. And you could talk to her further about this, but in our own society, it's interesting to note that we're like number 36 in the world in resources that we give to children and in the factors that measure health and vitality of children. We're way down. We're like with Belarus or somewhere like that. These are important things. Michael Sleesman is the managing director of the Center for Bioethics here. And I don't know if Mike's here today, but yeah, Mike's here. And, you know, the such important work that's done around issues of life and ethics. And Mike said something to me that I thought was really, really good. He says, you know what, in the garden, because there's all of these ways to choose life, and there's only one way to choose death. It was all about life, one way to choose death, and that's, of course, what we chose. Dr. Joe Foydick is a medical doctor. Joe works with patients, but also with insurance companies and with issues around that, and he's very concerned about the inequity, the inequality of health care. I think that's a life issue, and that's a life issue for Christians to be concerned about. Susan Sheehan has walked with so many people at the end of life, to help them find a good death. And that is a phrase we can use, to find a good death. And there are others as well here. There's counselors and teachers and others who really call forth life. And, you know, we're a community of those who affirm life in its various dimensions. We all have, no matter what our calling, our vocation in life is, we have a place to call forth life in others, and we have opportunity to choose life for ourselves and for our community. And that's so important because we know the giver of life. We know the one who pours out his grace over us, who says, choose life and celebrate it. Like abundant wine poured out freely, a culture of life in the midst of a culture of death and violence all around us, in our communities, in the larger world that we face. You know, these can be simple things, simple ways of calling people to life, simple ways of reminding people of the sacredness of life. Even when we find ourselves in extremely painful and difficult and deprived situations, to know the life of God is not far from us. The life of God is in us as his people. You know, the actor Bill Murray, I think you know Bill Murray, claimed last year that a work of art saved his life. I don't know if you've heard this or read this. He was in Chicago for his first experience as an actor, and the acting experience went so poorly, so terribly, he said he walked out of the theater and onto the street, and he just kept walking for a couple of hours. He said, I realized I walked in the wrong direction, and not in the wrong direction from where I live, but in the desire to stay alive, and he headed for Lake Michigan. He said, I thought if I'm going to die, I may as well go over toward the lake and just float a bit. He said, so I walked toward the lake, and I reached Michigan Avenue. I started walking north, and somehow I ended up in front of the Art Institute, and I walked inside. There was a painting there of a simple peasant woman working in a field with a sunrise behind her. I always loved that painting. I saw it that night, and I said, look, there's a girl without a whole lot of prospects. But the sun's coming up. and she's got another chance at it. I said, I'm a person too, and I will get another chance every single day. And after gazing at the painting, he decided to live. The painting is called The Song of a Lark by Jules Breton. I'm not holding up Bill Murray as like an example of the Christian life. I'm just saying that it can be simple things that lead people to life, to make decisions about life. And maybe you're unaware that the simple things that you can offer to the people within your circle of influence are very significant. Just like just wine poured, right? Whatever that might mean for you. At Cana, we see Jesus revealed, even though most of the wedding guests were unaware. We experience grace and abundance, delight and wonder. We can't put our finger on it exactly, but something is changing here. Something is afoot. There's hope in the air with this miracle and sign. There's possibility. There's real life to be lived, even in the midst of our broken situations. So let's taste. Let's taste and see that the Lord is good. Amen.